if you don't understand what's going on in the clinic, you go back to the lab and you figure that out. Once you figure that out, you go back to the clinic and you apply it. You're not going to do the best science if you're not in the clinic. You know, and as a clinician, you try to use the best science you can.
Hello, welcome to the Seasoned RD, a podcast connecting newer professionals in the field of eating disorders
to those of us who have been around for a while. I'm your host, Beth Harrell, a certified eating disorders registered dietitian and supervisor.
And I'm Abby Brown, a registered dietitian who is newer to the field.
I think of myself as a well-seasoned cast iron skillet with wisdom and experience, yet always ready for something new.
And I think of myself as an Instapot with innovation and a fresh perspective. This podcast brings both to the table to share ingredients, recipes, and techniques of past and present so we can all be our best for the future.
The kettle is heating up. A skillet is on simmer. So join us around the table for true professional nourishment. Abby, ready to stir the pot?
Let's do it.
Hello, everyone. This is Beth, your host of the Seasoned RD, registered dietitian, working today with Dr. Sarah Gould, clinical director of the Eating Disorders Program at Children's Mercy Hospital, and Dr. Kelsey Forbush, who carries many hats, and I'll let her introduce herself, is a researcher. What is the biggest conundrum that we have as practitioners working with those with eating disorders? Well, I will say the biggest one. There's two huge ones on my mind. One is getting people who so desperately need a higher level of care, getting them to that higher level of care. And then the one that we're talking about in this episode, part one, there is a part two, is what is the, you know, we know that there's a high recidivism rate, repeat admits to higher levels of care. And I'm seeing more and more people coming to my practice that say, I do not want and I will not take another higher level of care. Why keep doing the same thing and getting the same results? Which means a lot of times when they go back into their world, they are not doing well. I used to think that there was this like wall between people in the field, in the trenches, and researchers. And we would say basically that those of us in the trenches are already discovering what research is just now proving to be right, that, you know, it takes a while for research to prove it. This is treatment-based evidence. And so it's the connection and the partnership for clinician voices and research voices. Here's the thing. I would love for all of you to fill up Dr. Forbush's, her lab's study that they're working on right now. And it studies, it's a really cool app. And the clinician gets their own app and the client gets their app and the clinician can take a look at some of the things that are happening. It's very different from some of the other apps. Also, I do believe there's payment for both the therapist clinician and for the client to participate in this study. So if you would like to enroll your client into this, the information is in the show notes. It will inform practice, but it is treatment-based evidence because you are the clinician with boots on the ground and you can make an impact on what we do for the future. So if we can all figure out how to stop the repeat admissions with the same outcomes, let's do it together. All right, information in the show notes, part one.
I am so excited to have both Dr. Sarah Gould and Dr. Kelsey Forbush here today to talk with us about research and partnerships with those kind of in the trenches. So Dr. Sarah Gould is clinical director of Children's Mercy Kansas City Eating Disorders Center, and Dr. Kelsey Forbush is a professor at the University of Kansas Clinical Child and Clinical Science Programs. And welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Dr. Forbush, and I'll just call you Kelsey if that's okay. This is a podcast for professionals, and I know that I want to give all the respect for what you, the doctor in front of your name is. And because we are all colleagues, I'd like to use Kelsey in this. Can you describe what your role is in your research and what you do?
Mm-hmm. So my research focuses on trying to develop clinically useful assessments, diagnostic systems and tools, so ways to help, for example, better inform prognosis that clinicians like and want to use and they find helpful. And then also a newer part of my research is developing treatments for eating disorders, particularly treatments that we think could be easier to disseminate and scale up so that more people can get the treatment that they need, and trying to figure out like ways to reduce barriers to accessing good quality care.
I love it. And many of you listening will know Dr. Forbush's work through the EPSI. Mm-hmm. Great. And Dr. Gould, Sarah, tell us a little bit about what you do.
Sure. I'm a psychologist and I do direct the Children's Mercy Eating Disorder Center. And we're an outpatient clinic, multidisciplinary. We're in the trenches and doing the things with kids and teens. So leave the adult work to folks like you. But.
Yeah, in the trenches. And this is what this podcast episode is about. How did you two develop your partnership?
Mm-hmm. Kelsey was new at KU and teaching a treatment of eating disorders graduate student class. And I think found us through Google. Is that right, Kelsey?
Well, I remember different. So I remember, I feel like Sarah Kirk, who is the director of our clinic, said, have you met Dr. Piper at Children's Mercy? And I said, no, I hadn't really heard much. And so she, I think, contacted Dr. Piper, who then contacted you and somebody named Whitney. Mm-hmm. And we went for coffee at Corner Bakery. I don't remember at what point this was, but I remember like going in with like, and really trying to think strategically of like, why would you might want to partner with me, or like, why might you want to use the EPSI? And so I had like a long list, but I didn't really get to my list. We just had a normal conversation at the end. At least how I remember it was that you and Whitney like looked at each other and then asked if you could use the EPSI. And I was like, yes, you may. So I was really excited that you'd like actually looked at the EPSI and like knew about it. And then I remember too, like kind of like after that, then teaching a treatment of eating disorders class and reaching out to see if like we could come and like tour and just like talk about what it's like to be a professional treating eating disorders.
Yeah, I just got my timeline reversed. I remember the coffee and I remember talking about the EPSI. And then I remember us asking, do you have a child version? Oh, yeah. And you said, no, not. And we were kind of like, do you want to have a child version? And that was really, because we do treat really young children sometimes, and we don't have great tools. We have some screening tools, but they're not as good for tracking progress. Mm-hmm. And that's really what our needs are.
I love that whole, I didn't really get to my list, you know, but you were at the Corner Bakery and you had an agenda and you had, but it was that whole like meeting each other, finding out what each other does, and then how can we help each other? How can we move forward with this? So what was the first project you worked on? Was it the child?
You're laughing.
They're laughing. I know you. Some of you can't see this, but they're laughing.
They're laughing. We're not done with that project yet.
Okay. How long ago was this? I have to ask. I know when. How many?
10 years ago.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah. We have a version and it's being tested. So yes, if any podcast listeners are interested and have a youth that they treat for eating disorders, we're really working hard on this measure. And I think that's one of the other things too about these partnerships is there's challenges and bumps in the road that happen, you know, unforeseeable stuff. And you just kind of like persist or figure out where to pivot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've done different kinds of projects over the years. And sometimes one kind of takes a back seat when there's another opportunity or when there's a student project, they need to graduate. So mm-hmm. timeline is most important in that context to help support them. And so we've been really flexible and organic really mm-hmm. in how things have shifted as we go.
Okay.
And we have made progress, significant progress on that project, but
yeah, and that's the child measure. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I interrupted you, Sarah.
Yeah, it will be, we're recruiting 10 through 18 year olds. And so we're trying to really get those preteen years in there as well. And because it would be, we think, we'll see what the research shows, but we think we'll end up being pretty similar to the EPSI, then we'll have a pediatric measure, an adult measure that can flow into each other And so nice. We don't have to switch measurement tools because you hit a certain age.
Okay. I like that. I love that, Epsy. I mean, money selling it to people, I would. But I mean, I just love it. So that's how much I love it. So the child measure is for the 10 to 18 year olds, which can then flow nicely into the EBSI, which is designed for adults.
Mm-hmm. I think
for all the validated too, down to age 13.
Yeah.
Okay. Validated. Okay.
But for those kids that are younger, especially, I think too, like having a tool where we could better identify eating disorders before they get to the severe point.
Yes.
It's really important. And that's one of the primary reasons that we are so passionate. I really, one of the things that we wanted to is community norms. Mm-hmm. So kind of dual purposes of when our eating behaviors starting to get problematic so that we can give people early, like secondary prevention or very, very immediate intervention. And then when our eating behaviors kind of back to normal or mm-hmm. things are getting worse and we need to refer to higher levels of care, if like we have some of the data on that, then we can provide different tools for clinicians so that they kind of feel more supported and can make evidence-based decisions when they need to.
You're speaking to my heart. Early interventions, community norms, and better informed prognosis is something you said earlier. And then, of course, treatments. Okay, so that's the child measure. What other things do you partner on, if there are, the two of you?
Really, so many things. I feel like, honestly, Sarah and I partner on almost all of the research. And even there's a study that Sarah and I aren't really collaborating on, but Sarah went to a conference and then sent me a list of things to think about that were really, really great based on kind of like her experience at the conference on going to a talk on military and eating disorders. So yes, I feel like we partner on almost everything. And I think it's like, I don't know, for me, it's really rewarding to work with Sarah because I feel like a lot of like the questions or issues that I think could be problematic, like Sarah can already think about like, how do we solve that? Or like, oh, this isn't going to work because of XYZ. So to me, it's just really like been a fun partnership.
Yeah, it really has. And it's very, very collaborative from step one. And so that's why I really love working with Kelsey, is because sometimes I think researchers with all of the best intentions and just because the world is siloed and et cetera, might bring clinicians in at the end for feedback of the project or product and to help with recruitment. And Kelsey is at the front, is I have this idea. What do you think? What do clinicians need? What's not working in our care delivery? And so we're starting with the very applied experience of what is it like to do this work? And then we're working backwards from that almost to the research design rather than that top down. And so I don't like grants. I will tell you, they are not the favorite part, but I do like money to do the work. So I'm helping in that. And then we're also, there are pieces where I'm like, that study design piece is going to be really hard to actually do as a clinician. Can we tweak it this way or that way? Or on one of our current studies that we will talk about in a moment, we need to track height and weight along the way because we're monitoring for anorexia and relapse from anorexia. And so we need to know if weight loss is occurring and just who is the best reporter for that. Some therapists don't take weight, but some families don't know weight time to time. And so we're working through those kinds of questions so that we're not proposing something down the road that was really dead in the water to start with.
I love this back and forth conversation to help inform. Tell me if I'm off base on this, but I've heard very seasoned clinicians talk about, of course, evidence-based treatment, which is Kelsey, that's what you are studying so that we have the data, versus treatment-based evidence, because treatment-based evidence comes first. We're out here, like you said, Sarah, in the trenches. And we're doing the work and we're across from our clients and our families and we're pulling in the tools, the modalities that we have, but we're also looking at the uniqueness of the client in front of us. And we may not do it manualized, right? We may pull in things that are parts of each, and it's like, oh, this is treatment-based evidence. I'm practicing things that aren't measured, but that can inform then the next study.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of what we're trying to do too with publications, et cetera, is create this feedback loop where there are clinician voices and researcher voices and use even the publications as a way to talk to each other. And so just an example of that is we have I don't think it's out yet, an upcoming publication in IJED, the International Journal of Eating Disorders, maybe it is out. I lost track.
It might be out. It's in the special issue on atypical anorexia nervosa. So if people want to look for that special issue, it's a great one. It's got a lot of good stuff in there.
Yeah. And that student in particular is very interested in non-traditional eating disorders, if we want to use that term, although I think we're all aware what we call atypical anorexia has been around forever.
And it's very common.
Yes, and very common. And so what we're seeing, or what that project helped us see, is that the DSM lays out these criteria, but how clinicians are actually diagnosing is not syncing up with that. So it's the DSM criteria that researchers are using typically to design their studies, to screen people in and out of participation. But that's a disconnect from how clinicians are seeing atypical anorexia and diagnosing it. And the biggest change in that is so the DSM requires significant weight loss. It does not define what that means. And so that is a little tricky to start with. But many clinicians aren't considering weight or weight changes at all in their diagnosis. They're looking purely at the behavioral and psychological symptoms. And so researchers need to know that, and clinicians need research that is flowing and it feels applicable to what they're doing, or they're not going to use it.
I would like for one of you to send me a link to the special issues in the IJED so that I can put it in the show notes. I don't think I have access to that journal. So we have the child measure. We talked about military. I know that there's more. And we're also talking about how you decide how these research projects are going to go. Mm-hmm. Kelsey, as I am sitting here and I've only got two on my list and I know there's more, I want our listeners to have access to all of these. And I'm also feeling overwhelmed. As a clinician and the day-to-day and thinking about what's in my inbox right now, and I don't want to feel inundated by it. And I also know that you have some real treasures that I want to learn more about and that I have to decide which ones I'm going to send clients to. So I don't know if you can help me with that overwhelm and summarizing some things.
Oh, okay. I don't know if we could also go back to the evidence-based care.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I just feel really passionate about this because of the training that I received. I went to a graduate school that was one of the first in the clinical science movement. So it's different from scientist practitioner. And I think a lot of people think clinical science is like you only do research. But the idea that we were trained in was like, you know, you can have practice on one hand and science on the other hand. And, you know, that scientist practitioner, you get trained in both. My program was like, there's no way you could decouple them. It's like you're holding your two hands together. If you don't understand what's going on in the clinic, you go back to the lab and you figure that out. Once you figure that out, you go back to the clinic and you apply it. And that the best scientists were the ones that were basically not trained in both like they're separate, but trained in both like they're fused together so tightly that you're not going to do the best science if you're not in the clinic, you know. And as a clinician, you try to use the best science you can. So that's been my training, and I'm so grateful for that training because I think really it gave me a different perspective and philosophy, and always made me feel like I am a clinician. Maybe not as expert as Sarah and not as involved. That's why I need that partnership. But that I don't want to be doing research that's not clinically useful either, right? Like it's not going to move the field forward in the way that we want with our science.
This is so eye-opening for me and part of my evolution that you've been doing this for years that way. That's how you were trained. And my perspective was they are separate. you know, practice on one hand, science on the other. And so this is refreshing. Thank you.
You're welcome. And it's a fun way to train my students and for them to see our partnership Sarah and I have, and for them to grow kind of up in a sense of like that being their training too, you know, because there's times where Sarah's going to comment on our supervision and I'm learning from Sarah, you know, more clinically. So it's just, it really truly is a partnership. And I think that's the model that I think works best. I will say I went to see a talk. I won't mention the details, but the person was really kind of complaining that clinicians weren't implementing this intervention, this very strong evidence-based intervention. And it was kind of like, well, you need to figure that out. Like, there's probably very, very good reasons why clinicians aren't. And when you don't partner together, then you kind of are like developing treatments into a void.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's what that, and it goes nowhere, all that hard work. Hmm. Yeah. There could be some real great nuggets in there, but if it goes into a void, it's lost. No, you know, where you're going to have small numbers of clinicians interested. It may be too expensive for clinicians to learn and all the time involved in it, and et cetera. So thank you for that. Appreciate.
And that actually leads really nicely into the project that is current and really, it I think is my favorite project of all that we've done in the last 10 years. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But one of them is we know relapse rates for anorexia and atypical anorexia are unacceptably high. And that particularly hits me, I think, in pediatrics, because some kids miss out really in big ways on this entire foundational developmental stage. And you can't get that back. You can try to recover and learn in different ways and et cetera, but you cannot go back and have your chance to have consistent friendships, to have consistent schooling, et cetera, if you're in higher level of care every few months. So that is the main outcome that we're looking at in this study, is how do we decrease rates of relapse, and looking specifically at anorexia and atypical anorexia, since they seem the hardest to shift of many of the presentations of eating disorders, and in young people. So 13 to 21 is the age group we're looking at there. And it's any kids, young adults with those diagnoses entering outpatient from higher levels of care, which could be medical stabilization, not eating disorder specialty care, all the way up to residential, all through the levels. We're trying to understand, and in that way, I should say, screen for more severe or complicated forms of the illness, not folks that are entering outpatient and then do just great. It's kids and young people who are trying to combat a pretty strong eating disorder. And the intervention is deployed through a mobile phone app. So you just download the app. And it's very private because no information is stored on your phone. It's just the phone is the interface. And so kids and young people can participate in these modules that provide education and support based on the unified protocol for eating disorders in one condition. I'll talk about the other in a minute. And it's interactive, so you get prompts and questions, and the wording of those questions, the application within them of how to apply the skills and concepts are based on what you said is your biggest area of concern through the APPS assessment that week. So trying to really get at that salience for teens of they don't care about anything except where they are today and what's in front of them right now. And so we're trying to incorporate that. And then the therapist that they're working with is also a study participant and gets those data, gets the responses that their patient put into the app, gets those assessment results, not just for that week, but also longitudinally. So how are those responses from that client changing week to week? And are they overall getting better, stable, getting worse? And to really give that feedback so that clinicians can respond faster when things are beginning to go off track, and in a really, really low time demand kind of way, just log onto the portal and all of those summary data are right there in front of you for that person that you're going to see in 10 minutes. And the other condition is PACT, which I'll let Kelsey do the acronym out for me in a minute because it cannot stick in my brain, is an intervention that was designed for PTSD, but through those studies, the researchers noticed that it also improved disorder eating symptoms. And so folks are randomized to one of those two conditions. So it is a randomized clinical control trial, but it is both active conditions. There's no control group, no placebo. We believe that both will help. We're just looking at how do they compare to each other and can the evidence-based treatments be transitioned into a phone app and help? If we change that format, do they still help? And that is done alongside whatever that therapist was going to do anyway, whether they're a specialist in eating disorders, a generalist, whoever. Mm-hmm. And so we also have a therapist guide that helps the clinician know what the app had in it that week and make suggestions for things you could follow up on session, but it's totally optional. It's just if that would be helpful to you or not, depending on how you typically work, what your experience is with these presentations already, et cetera. And then we just look over time. Does it help? Do we keep more young people in the community?
Thank you for listening. And if you want to connect with me for all things eating disorders and disordered eating from an RD, registered dietitian perspective, there are three ways to do that. One is my membership, and actually two of those ways are my membership. There's a tier one and a tier two, but the membership is for anyone, not only professionals, anyone who wants to join the conversation about medical, nutrition, therapy perspectives floating through my brain, things that I've learned through the podcast, things that I've learned in my 3+ decades of work with all ages. And the membership has monthly content with the two tiers. Tier one is the content and a text community where we can share ideas. And tier two is once per month with a live coffee talk where you can just pop in and say hi, or you can be a fly on the wall and just listen to some ideas related to that month's theme. And then finally, for professionals, I offer small consult groups that run from January to June and July to December, usually therapists and RDs, but I would love to have a medical provider. And I offer individual consultation. Information on all this is in the show notes.